Okay, so for those of you who want to know about medical ethics, we're still going to get there. We're just not quite there yet. I actually gave a clear class on Shabbat to know at which point you could put your parents in a home. So maybe we can do that also. Don't worry. Okay. Anyway, we'll get to that also because it's the
class that was requested of you. By popular demand.
No, the truth is that on Shabbat it happened to be a discussion in Daf Yomi on that topic, so that's why. Because when guys learn Daf Yomi, they don't pay attention to what it really says. They just like learn it quickly. They don't realize what the implication. You'll see. When we get there, we'll see it. I just wanted to start off and say that that the learning that we'll do today will be in memory of my mother-in-law who passed away this morning. And she would have appreciated that I went to teach this morning. She was a woman who lost her mother when she was on 15 and raised all of her younger siblings and never had a childhood. And she was a kind of person who really didn't tolerate frivolous things like vacations and free time and things like that. And she worked most of her life three jobs. But her primary job that she worked was as a secretary in Yeshiva of Crown Heights. Even though she had an open offer as being a legal secretary, which she ended up doing in the afternoons and evenings, and she could have earned a decent salary by doing that in the day, but she decided that she wanted to work in the yeshiva because she wanted to work with kids and she thought that was important. So if you understand that, then I think you'd understand why she would have appreciated the learning today.
What's her name?
Bernice Linder. She also worked as a typist. I would assume that I was going to say most people in Brooklyn, New York, who wrote masters or doctorates, she typed them. Okay. Somebody said something in class yesterday, and then somebody else emailed me afterwards, which took me in this direction. So I'll start with a story. It's not a nice story, but it's a story nonetheless. I was a guest rabbi in a yeshiva in Israel over Shabbat. And this is one of these many, many yeshivot, which will remain, we won't reveal the identity of the yeshiva or the Rosh Yeshiva, but it's one of these many, many places where kids come for the year, and then, or maybe two, and then they go back, and it caters almost exclusively to Americans. So I was invited there at least one time, maybe more. I've spoken there a number of times. And over the Shabbat, the Rosh Yeshiva gets up, I think it was after davening, Shabbat morning, and he gives a dvar halacha. Right? He has to teach a little halacha. I don't know how long it was, 20 minutes, half an hour. So he teaches them basically what we're going to learn today. But what was very interesting to me was his starting point and his conclusion. Essentially, he was trying to tell them that when you go back home and your parents, or especially your mothers, don't know exactly how you're supposed to prepare food for Shabbat or warm up food for Shabbat. So it's very important to know, you know, what you can do and what you can't do and how you can't eat the food that they warm up. This was basically his conclusion, was how to go home and to show them, you know, he didn't say this in this many words that now I'm reading between the lines, to show how frum you've actually gotten, that you're frum enough that you can't eat from your mother's food. And I'm listening to him talk and him being his learned explanation of this whole thing. And I went over afterwards and I asked him, you know, how he came to such a conclusion based upon all kinds of considerations. And we'll see those considerations today. But somebody had asked me, you know, how do you negotiate between different
levels?
It's not even different levels. You know, meaning, what really is ethics? Ethics is not just to do the right thing. Ethics is to do the right thing when you have multiple considerations. Which means if there's just one consideration, that's not a question of ethics, that's a question of decency, right? Ethics is when you have opposite issues confronting you, and now you need to know how to negotiate with those conflicting issues to come out of it. I mean, everybody clearly understands, which means if there is a poor person on the street and you have a lot of money, and they're starving, and they need food, for you to give them money is not considered ethical behavior. That's decent behavior. But when it comes to a question of you have money, and now you want to know where to give that to, that when they're in terms of prioritizing, then things become a little bit more interesting. I mean, over here, right away, in a question like this, you have immediately all of us can understand. On the one hand, there's sensitivities and issues of the laws of Shabbat. And all of us appreciate laws of Shabbat are very important. On the other hand, you have something which is called Kibud Av V'Em, which is also in Judaism something which is very important. Now, there will be some people who won't go any further than this and say, well, you know what? Honoring your mother is more important, and throw out the rest of it. I mean, I've taught too many years in a Baal Tshuva yeshiva as well, where you'll have, it's almost ingrained, you'll have most secular parents will tell their kids who want to become religious, doesn't Judaism teach that you honor your parents? They say, yes, I don't want you to be religious. So that doesn't necessarily win out, you know, doesn't trump every other consideration. Which means honoring parents is very important. Now the question is, okay, are there limitations? And we all know there are limitations. On the other hand, keeping Shabbat is something that's very important, and you know what? But even in terms of Shabbat, there are some limitations. So in a case like this, what wins out? Now, in the mind of this particular Rosh Hashiva, and this isn't even a case, I'm sorry for interrupting myself, this isn't even a case of theoretical law versus practical law. As I told you 2 weeks ago, this is a question of ignorance of law. This is a question of somebody just not really being well enough versed in it. And maybe, if you really argued with me, then I would back down and would say, okay, it could be that in theory, some of the things he's saying is right, but I'm not going to go that far. Okay, let's start, and we'll try to get through this whole topic today, even though you have lots of pages, but first of all, we're supposed to keep Shabbat. Is that good? Is that clear? No debate? Good. And what does it mean keeping Shabbat? There are 39 melachot that you can't do. On top of the 39 melachot, there's something else. And what's that? That's this amorphous other thing called Shabbistik. Shabbistik. The things have to be Shabbistik. How do you say that in English? Beruach Shabbat. How do you say it? I remember a number of years ago, we had a Shabbat in Yeshivat Har Etzion for all the alumni in Gush. And instead of having Rav Lichtenstein speak to us, which we did for many years and years and years, they decided to have a session with his wife, with Tova Lichtenstein. So like some of the people, the husbands, the wives, were asking, you know, what do you advise doing with the kids who want to play ball on Shabbat, or play soccer on Shabbat? So she said, I'm shocked. I never saw any kids play, you know, when I was growing up in Boston, nobody ever played. Meaning, the questions that we bring up, she was just very surprised that we're there. But there is a thing in Judaism called the spirit of Shabbat. We're not going to cover that today, but I will tell you, according to a number of people's opinion, that's a Torah law, the spirit of Shabbat. Because on top of all the lam tet melacha, don't do melacha, lo taseh kol melacha, it also says, of Yom HaShvi'i, tish bot. And on the seventh day, have a Shabbat. That's a positive commandment. Meaning, after you've covered all the negative commandments, there's also a positive commandment. And what is? Make sure that after you've gone through the checklist, I didn't do borer, and I didn't do whatever winnowing. Not that I know what winnowing is. And I didn't do the rest of these things. Then the bottom line should still be: now, did I create a Shabbat? Important discussion, but not for now. Yeah.
Is that where like the white tablecloths and stuff come in?
It could be a stretch. It could be a stretch, but probably more importantly, it's going to come into situations where rabbis have to say, you know, that's really not in the spirit of Shabbat. Like somebody could ask, well, what would be the problem with leaving a television on Shabbat or something like that? So all rabbis, that's not Shabbistic. Now, did the rabbis in the Gemara, did Moshe Rabbeinu know? No, but there is gray area here that we need to say, after I do everything else, how do I ensure that there is still Shabbat resulting from all the things that I'm doing or not doing. You have to keep Shabbat. That part is easy. Now, what if you break Shabbat? What are the ramifications of breaking Shabbat? And, you know, I can off the top of my head now throw you lots of different issues. Are you allowed to benefit from the breaking of Shabbat? For example, let's say you need to get to the airport the second that Shabbat is over. Can you call a cab before Shabbat and say, I want you to be by my door the second Shabbat is over? Right? Can you call him before Shabbat and say, I want you waiting by my door the second Shabbat is over? What would? So you're making him drive on Shabbat. By the way, if your plane lands half an hour before Shabbat, can you get in a taxi to go home with the taxi? If he's your next door, yeah. Otherwise, the guy lives in, you get in the thing, he says, I live in Tel Aviv. He takes you home, you'll get in your house 2 minutes before Shabbat, but now he's going to have to drive.
You're talking about Jewish cab
drivers. I'm talking about Jewish cab drivers.
You're talking about landing in O'Hare.
Never heard of it. Never heard of it. But correct. If it's non-Jews, then it's also, that's a separate interesting issue, which we may touch parenthetically. Are you allowed to get on a bus that started out before Shabbat ended and get on the bus 20 minutes after Shabbat is over? Right? I don't know in Yerushalayim what time the bus, I don't know what time the, what, I don't even know how much buses cost anymore. Does anybody know when the buses start after Shabbat?
Half an hour.
Now, there are cities in Israel that that's not the case. There are cities in Israel that they start a little bit earlier. Right, and that's amazing, isn't it? Semi-kosher restaurants. There was once a pizza store in our neighborhood that they wanted me to give the hechsher, but the guy had a little bit of a problem, and that they need to warm up the oven, they need like at least an hour or so in advance. And he would go in Shabbos afternoon and put on the oven, and I said, that's it. People can't go in it. But these are part of the issues that we need to understand. Now, there's two possibilities. What are the two possibilities of somebody? Okay, so the topic is benefiting from work done on Shabbat. That's the topic. That's our topic for today. Benefiting from work done on Shabbat. But of course, we have to eventually get to this issue of our clash within ethics. There's two possibilities. One possibility is that the person deliberately broke Shabbat. What's the other possibility? It was not deliberately breaking Shabbat.
This is only between Jews.
Only between Jews.
Are we talking about benefiting?
No. Let's start with Jews. Non-Jewish helpers become very interesting because of technical reasons. For example, are you allowed to wash your dishes on Shabbat? So if you'll need them for another meal, then certainly. If you don't like the mess that they're making, then also. Are you therefore allowed to ask your non-Jewish person working for you to wash the dishes? Yes, because you're allowed to do it, they can do it. Are they allowed to use the dishwasher? Yes, because they don't have to keep Shabbat. You're allowed to ask them to wash the dishes, but once they wash the dishes, they can wash the dishes however they want to wash the dishes, and that's not really your issue. So I'm saying, when it comes to Jews and non-Jews, there are all kinds of subtleties, and I don't want to cover. They can use the hot water. They can take a shower for you. Okay. They can brush their teeth.
Yeah,
okay.
They can't heat
a
liquid for you.
Correct. Because then they're doing it for you. Because then they're doing it for you. In this case, they're doing it for themselves. Why are they putting on the dishwasher? For themselves. Because they don't want dishpan hands. But why would they be cooking the food for you? I gave you a hint just now. For you, right? No. If it's for them, then there are all kinds of other laws coming into consideration. So again, let's leave non-Jews out of this. I'm sorry. Let's just pick. We'll get to non-Jews also. We'll get to the non-Jews also then. Okay, I'll get to the non-Jews. So, are you allowed to benefit from a Jew doing work on Shabbat? So, what's the answer? Maybe. Just say machloket. That's the right answer to everything. So let's take a look in the first source. This first source, we randomly picked a Gemara in Chulin, even though there were three other places in the Gemara that has the same discussion. But we picked this one. Hamivashel b'Shabbat. Now, there's two words you need to know. One word, three words. First word is mevashel, means cook. Second word is shogeg, which means accident. And third word is mezid, which means on purpose. We're going to see three opinions over here, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yochanan HaSandlar. So, if you want to make your own charts and to figure out what each of them say, you can. Let's start. It starts with the most lenient opinion. Hamavashel b'Shabbat b'shogeg ye'ochel. What does ye'ochel mean? One second, is this ye'ochel? One second, let me take a second. Sorry, we'll get to ye'ochel later. Sorry, I take that back. Hamavashel b'Shabbat b'shogeg yochal. He can eat it, which means the person who cooked it can eat it. which means if you made a mistake on Shabbat, according to Rabbi Meir, and you cook something you weren't allowed to cook. Now, is he talking about warming something up or cooking?
Cooking.
Cooking.
So he says. How does that happen with Shogeg?
There's a couple of. You don't remember. Once Shogeg could be you don't remember it's Shabbat. Or you learned all 39 malachot.
You thought Shabbat started at 7 and then you didn't realize they changed the clocks because you're in Montana.
Or you only, or you, Montana?
Okay.
We didn't know exactly what time Shabbat is, so, you know. Except to see when the sun goes down. Right, but let's say you missed that one
exactly.
It's
half of
it.
Or, in your learning, I'll give you two more cases of Shogeg. One case of Shogeg would be, and by the way, what is Shogeg? Just about anything which isn't mazed. What's mazed? On purpose. Now, there's all kinds of cases that it could be. It wasn't on purpose. What does mazed mean? You're deliberately breaking Shabbat. Somebody comes over and he says, listen, it's Shabbat. And you say, you smile and you'll say, I don't care. I like cooking on Shabbat. It tastes better when I cook on Shabbat. Right? That's mazed. What would Shogeg be? Shogeg would be, you don't know it's Shabbat.
Without intention.
Right, without intention. So Shogeg would be, you didn't know it's Shabbat. You didn't know you're not allowed to cook. You were juggling eggs and one fell in the chillens, right? It happens. Or you didn't know what you're doing is considered cooking.
The dog turned on the oven.
Okay. I see a lot of you had excuses prepared for not doing your homework.
Wait, excuse me. This cooking category.
Yes. Good. Yeah, we're told later on that this is just an example, and it's talking about really any of the 39 categories of work.
Okay. So okay. Anything involving
not just food. Any breaking of Shabbat is included in this. This is just an example. Hamivashel b'Shabbat b'Shogeg. By the way, what if your rabbi tells you it's allowed? It's really not allowed. Is that on purpose or is that Shogeg?
That's Shogeg.
Hamavashel b'Shabbat b'Shogeg yochal. The person who did it, they're allowed to eat it. Why can they eat it?
Because
it was an accident. B'mezid lo yochal. But if you broke Shabbat on purpose, you're not allowed to eat it. By the way, you'll now tell me, but most people who break Shabbos on purpose are not going to care that they can eat it. Okay, you broke Shabbos at 10 o'clock, you did Shuva at 12 o'clock, and now you want to know if you can have lunch. No, not even, you didn't even eat it yet. It was done, and now you realized that it was done. Right. Div Rabbi Meir, that was the opinion of Rabbi Meir. So first opinion of Rabbi Meir, I will already hint to you now, is the most lenient. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, b'shogeg, if you did it by accident, yochal b'motzoi Shabbat, then you can only eat it after Shabbat is over. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. B'mezid, lo yochal olamit. You can never eat it, according to Rabbi Yehuda. So, Rabbi Meir said by accident you can eat it, on purpose you can't eat it till after Shabbat. Rabbi Yehuda says by accident you can eat it after Shabbat, on purpose you can never eat it. Rabbi Yochanan Hasanlar Omer, b'shogeg yochal l'motzoi Shabbat la'acherim v'lo lod b'mezid lo yochal olamit. That he says, Rabbi Yochanan Sandler says, if it was by accident, you can never benefit. Which means, he's saying, when you cook on Shabbat, even by accident, there's a stain on that food for you, and you can never derive benefit of it. It's inappropriate. By the way, in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, if you broke Shabbat by accident, would you be required to bring a korban? Yeah. So he's saying, this is something which is requiring you to do tshuva, requiring you to fix something. It's not appropriate for you to ever use this. Someone else can use it, but only after Shabbat. Not why not on Shabbat? He doesn't want you to have any benefit from what was done on Shabbat. But what if it was done b'mezid? Then no one can ever make use of this. But by the way, what happens if somebody films a sporting event on a Shabbat afternoon? Right? So,
can you watch it?
I remember. I didn't say tape. I said somebody by the field there is filming it and is breaking Shabbat as he's filming it. So what would be the opinion according to each one of these opinions? First of all, the person doing it, is it Shogeg or Mezid?
Mezid.
So right now, so okay, so correct. So we don't know what the religious background of the camera person is. So that becomes something which is interesting. Let's even say it was done. He does know. He went to yeshiva and he knows everything and he's doing it anyway. He doesn't care. So now, according to Rabbi Meir, what would the halacha be? That means. According to Rabbi Meir, what would Rabbi Meir say about someone else watching after Shabbat? So admit, you don't know.
Well, he's allowed to benefit from it, let's say Shabbat.
On purpose? In a case, on purpose. Okay, so let's go to according to Rabbi Yehuda. What would Rabbi Yehuda say? Let's assume that for the moment. Okay, let's make it easy. Rav Yochanan Hassan Lar, what would he say?
No.
Okay, now, many Rishonim claim that there's overlapping in the opinions here, that what Rav Yochanan Hassan Lar says by Shogeg is what Rav Yehuda says by Mezid, and what Rav Meir says by Shogeg, sorry, what Rav Yehuda says by Shogeg is what Rav Meir says by Mezid. Who followed that? Do we need to make a chart and stuff?
Yeah.
We really do. I wish if I were a real teacher, I'd be making a chart for you now. But I'm not. So if any real teachers are here, then feel free. But let's try that one more time. And this time, and this time, you're a real teacher, right?
Yeah, I'm a real teacher.
So let's work backwards, and then we'll figure out what everybody says. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what I want to work backwards. Let's work backwards. What does Yochanan Sandler say? He says that if something was done on accident, other people can use it, he can never use it. If it's done on purpose, no one can ever use it, right? So if he but what he's saying by accident is others can't use it, so then presumably when Rabbi Yehuda then says that if it's on purpose, other people can't use it, it means others as well. Sorry, one more time. Rabbi Yochanan Sandler says, B'shogig yochel matzoy shabbat la'acherim velo lo. Sorry, I take that back. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda would say the same thing, that after Shabbat, others can use it and not him. Is that correct? That would be correct. The only twist in all this would be something that we don't know. And what if a person broke Shabbat, but deliberately for you? Which means you go into a hotel, which is a Jewish-owned hotel, and the people are cooking for you. And they give you food, which they... So now, what do you do with it? Now, Rashi over here has a long discussion, lots of explanations, and I'm not sure exactly how far to go into this. But you know what? Before we do Rashi, let's go a little bit further in the Gemara, because there's a very interesting thing that happens with this Gemara. First of all, what's the most important thing we need to know? Who's the law according to? Because this can be a major difference between it being Rav Yochanan Sandler and being Rabbi Meir, obviously with Rav Yehuda in the middle. According to Rav Yochanan Sandler, the law of benefiting from things done on Shabbat is a Torah law. Which, and you know what, let me even try to be a little bit clearer so that you can understand how things work. Rav Yochanan Sandler claimed that if I cook on Shabbat on purpose, you can't benefit from it. Why not? Why should you be punished?
There's
see,
something tainted about food.
Right, which is interesting, because and I'm being a little bit superficial here, but not enough that you're going to be bored. I mean, a little superficial meaning that people can argue with this, but I think this is the best way to understand it. Rabbis have a mandate, and the Torah has a mandate. What is the rabbi's mandate? What can the rabbis control? All that they can control is they can tell people what to do. Which means, is pork not kosher? That's an easy question. Is it kosher? No. Why not? Because the Torah says. Okay? Milk and meat together, is that not kosher? Milk and meat together, cooked together. Right. So now, what the rabbis can tell you is not to eat something, but the rabbis can't tell you that something isn't kosher. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you right now, I'm being somewhat superficial, because the rabbi's mandate is on people, but not on things. They can't change reality. even though that if there were a bunch of rabbis in the room, they would argue with me and bring me cases why you could, why you couldn't. That's why I'm saying I'm being a little bit superficial over here. But when I see something that says that nobody can eat it, then I already begin to suspect this is a Torah law, not a rabbinic law. When I see a law saying, well, if you cook something on Shabbat, you can't eat it, that's as if I'm giving you a fine, I'm giving you a punishment. You're being punished for what you did, so that seems to be more on a rabbinic level. Because the rabbis can give out fines to people, but they can't say the food isn't kosher, which means, again, forget about somebody cooking for you on purpose. Somebody cooked for themselves, so then why can't I use it, you know, 3 months later? Why can't I use it? What did Yochanan Sandler say? That no one can ever use this afterwards. That's a little strange. So what's he saying? The food isn't kosher. Whether the other person knows about it, doesn't know about it, you have to run and tell them, no, that food's not kosher. Why? Because this person cooked it on Shabbat. So it sounds as if the last opinion of Yochanan Sandler is a Torah law. On the other hand, the other two opinions, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, they sound like that they understand that this law is on a rabbinic level. Because what they're claiming is that there's a fine which will be received when a person breaks Shabbat. What's Rabbi Yehuda claiming? That the fine goes if you even break Shabbat by accident. What's Rav Meir saying? The fine only makes sense if you break Shabbat on purpose. So Rav Meir is saying that if you broke Shabbat by accident, then the rabbis don't have to come in and fine you for it. If you broke Shabbat on purpose, then you do it. Rav Yehuda is saying, even if you broke it by accident on Shabbat, then you should still be getting a fine. And that's the way to understand the increasing levels of severity according to the different opinions, because they fundamentally see the law as being, you know, somewhat different. Yeah.
Is the third opinion the source that if you cook on Shabbos, all of your dishes are treif and your oven is treif?
You know what? The Magen Avraham quotes that. I actually cut that out because I didn't want to go there at all. But there is.
The source of it, that it's a Torah law and that it actually stains the food.
What they're claiming is that there's it's interesting because if it's on a rabbinic level, so why should it affect the pots? So it must be affecting the pots on a rabbinic level. But let's hold on to the pots. I don't want to talk about them. Tani Tana Kamei Derav. We're four lines down in the Hebrew source from the second word in. Tani Tana Kamei Derav. Any of you remember what a Tana is? Tani Tana Kamei Derav, a Tana taught in front of Rav. And what did he say? Hamavashel b'Shabbat b'Shogeg Yochal, b'Meizid lo Yochal. Whose opinion did he quote?
Rav Meir.
Umashtik le Rav. And what did Rav say? Shh. He shod him. Mashtik, from the word l'shtok, mashtik le Rav. Rav silenced him. My time amashtiklei. Why did he silence him? If you're going to claim the reason he silenced him is because Rav himself followed the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, the Tani Tana Kerv Meir, while the Tana taught according to Rav Meir, Bishim Desfir Lei Kerv Yehuda, Manda Tani Kerv Meir, Mashtiklei. Just because someone has a different opinion, you're going to silence him? Va'od, Misar V'la Kerv Yehuda. Who says that Rav follows Rabbi Yehuda? V'ha Amar Rav Chanan Bar Ami. And we have a tradition that Rav Chanan, the son of Ami, reported, Kimor le Rav le Talmide, when Rav taught this law to his students in the yeshiva, Mor lehu k'Rabbi Meir, he followed the opinion of Rabbi Meir. V'chidorish bepirka, have you heard of something called Yarchi Kala? Yarchi Kala is when people would come a couple times a year, the masses would come to study. Pirka is a time. When people would come during the, it really means the public lectures, but not to the yeshiva students. He taught according to Yehuda in public because of the ignorant people that were around. Now this is very, very interesting. Because here we finally find a source for something that you've long suspected, mm-hmm. that rabbis say different things to different audiences. There are many beautiful stories like that, but it's slightly different than this. I mean, you're right, and the way that it's told over in one particular version of it is that this rabbi went against all the other rabbis. He went against the Ramban, he went against the Beit Yosef, and he found one opinion, And someone says, how can you go against all these books? He said, in Olam Haba, I'd rather have an argument with Rama about not listening to him than have an argument with God about not taking care of a poor woman. I mean, so that's a fair statement, but what caused, in your story, what causes him to take the lenient opinion is because the woman happens to be poorer. That's not the case over here. Oh, what? Which means he's teaching the masses the stricter one, but his yeshiva students, he tells them the secret, what the real halacha is. So that becomes a little strange. But what was the concern, what we said at the end? The Amiya Aretz. Now, if we try to figure out why this would be, or what's going on over here, I have a suspicion what it is. You can tell me if you agree or disagree. According to what we just now read, what does Rav think the halacha is? According to Rav Meir or according to Rabbi Yehuda? Rav Meir. And we all remember the difference. What's the difference? Rav Meir says if you broke Shabbat by accident on Shabbat, you can eat it. But on the other hand, we find that when the Tana started quoting Rabbi Meir, he quieted him. So the Gemara says, oh, maybe he doesn't agree with him. He says, of course he agrees with him. We know that Rav taught that way to his students. But when he was in public, then he wouldn't teach that way. Now why not? What is shogeg? So shogeg, we said, is an accident. What are the different reasons for the accident? One is you don't know it's Shabbat. One, you don't know... You're ignorant of the halacha. Now, if the masses find out that if you break Shabbat on act by accident because you didn't know the halacha,
like, hey.
That would therefore be a reason not to learn halacha. So therefore, on an educational level, to tell people that ignorance of the law helps you in this case would cause there to be more ignorance, and that's why I think he's saying, no, there are these ignorant people. I don't want them to know that if you're ignorant of the law, then you can benefit from it. I don't want people to benefit from ignorance. Therefore, when it came to the masses, he told them, the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, you can't use it till after Shabbat, because he didn't want them to be encouraged not to study. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the way that I understand that line of the Gemara. Yes? No?
It just shows that he has no faith
in ignorant people. How many people do you know who would say, including people in this room, because I've heard you say it, I don't want to study this because if I study then I have to do this. Okay?
The precedent that is very problematic today, which is teaching people, you know, 2 or 3 hachmarot past what actual halacha is, and then those people think that's halacha, and then they take it through 2 or 3
right.
levels deeper, and it's like a friend of mine once said, if the Rambam were alive today, none of us would eat on his dishes. You know?
For good reason. Like, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's a problem. But it also puts you as a teacher. I could say it the other way. I shouldn't teach the laws of halachot, because then I'm going to be causing people to be transgressing. So better I shouldn't teach them.
Right. So look, normally we want people to have knowledge. Normally we want people to grow in learning. Over here, knowledge of this particular law would create motivation not to learn more, and therefore teaching them this particular law would be counterproductive, and that seems to be why there's a discrepancy between what Rav would teach privately, what Rav would teach publicly, what he would teach his own students versus what he would teach in his public lectures. Can I ask you a conclusion, my learned colleagues? So what's the halacha? Is the halacha like Yochanan Sandler? Is the halacha like Rabbi Meir or like Rabbi Yehuda? Now, that's very interesting. The Gemara just left Rabbi Yochanan Sandler, didn't even bother Rabbi Yochanan Sandler, leaves it behind. The Gemara here is debating, well, does Rav follow Rabbi Meir or does he follow Rabbi Yehuda? That seems to be the only question over here. And what's the conclusion over here? The conclusion is that he follows Rav Meir, but he has a consideration maybe not to telling people about, but he follows Rav Meir. So if I had to ask you, and as I told you, this Gemara is quoted in 3 different places. It's quoted with slight variances in the different places. But if you had to right now decide what the halacha is, what would you say? I think that the conclusion would be very clear that the halacha is according to Rav Meir. Now, what happens? What happens is...
Can I just clarify something? We're using Bishul as a metaphor for all Chilul Shabbat.
Yes.
So we're talking about turning on lights.
Yes.
We're talking about
all things. Yeah, Rashi has an interesting thing over here. If you look where it's underlined, it's verse 2, lo yochal, bo bayom, you can't eat it that day, ad shetechshach, till it gets dark, uvichdei sheyasu, which is a wonderful 2 words, kdei sheyasu. Do you know what that means? the amount of time it would have taken you to do it. Mm-hmm. So Rashi just now threw a whole different thing in it that's not right in the Gemara. Rashi just said, well, if you're not allowed to benefit from what was done on Shabbat, then how long after Shabbat can you benefit from it? For the amount of time it would have taken you to do it. Otherwise, you're benefiting from what was done on Shabbat. So that's a very interesting thing, but I do want to point out the Gemara didn't say that. The Gemara says you can't benefit. Now, why can't I benefit from it on Shabbat? Because it was done on Shabbat. But maybe the second Shabbat is over. It's no longer Shabbat, so I can use it. Rashi just now threw more time into it. So therefore, if somebody warmed up their pizza oven, which took 2 hours, and then they cooked the pizza, which took another 15 minutes, Rashi would then tell you you have to wait 2 hours and 15 minutes to eat it, while the Gemara would sound like it only would have to wait 15 minutes to eat it. Well, not even 15 minutes. Maybe even the second Shabbat is over, you can eat it. Okay? So Rashi threw that into the discussion as well. Rashi then goes into the whole discussion if this is a Torah law, a rabbinic law, and again, Rav Yochanan Sanlo, there's reason to believe it's a Torah law. Source 3, Tosfot, Moru Lohu Kirby Meir, Mashma Shekein Halacha. That when Rav taught publicly, like Rav Meir, what can I conclude from that? That's the halacha. Which means Tosfot had the same conclusion that we had, and that really should be the end of the discussion. On the other hand, the Rambam, remember the Rambam? Remember the Rambam doesn't quote any of his sources, and he doesn't tell us exactly what he believes? Let's read the Rambam in source 4. Yisrael sha'asa malacha b'shabbat. You notice what he did, first of all? And it's no longer specifically the case of the Gemara. It's no longer bishul, it's no longer cooking. Yisrael sha'asa malacha b'shabbat. So a Jew who did any malacha on Shabbat, im aver va'asa bizadon, if he did it on purpose, asur lo lanot ba'oto malacha le'olam, he can never have benefit of this. Vishar Yisrael mutar lehem lihanot ba lemotzoi Shabbat miyad. And everyone else can have benefit immediately after Shabbat. So what can you now conclude about the Rambam? Who does he agree with? First, he disagreed with Rashi regarding Kadesh Shayasu. He doesn't have Kadesh Shayasu. We'll see in a moment that the Rambam knows the law of Kadesh Shayasu, but does not apply it in this case. He applies it in a different case. What else do we see? Who did he agree with? Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, Rav Yochanan? To Rav Yehuda. In source 5, the Rambam brings a halacha that if a Jew asked a non-Jew to do work for him, Yisrael sha'omer l'goy la'asot l'malacha zu b'shabbat, afa b'sha'avu makin otomat kat mardot, even though he'd get punished on a rabbinic level, mutar l'not ba'oto malacha, you're allowed to make use of it le'erev, at night, achar shiyamtin b'ktei sheta'aseh, after you wait the amount of time it would have taken to do it. The Rambam only believes there's a law of kadesh sheya'aseh by a non-Jew. Why? Why? She'im tomar ye mutar miyad, if you would tell me, used immediately, yom alagoy la'asot lo, then Jews will always be asking non-Jews to do things for them, v'yimtza hadavar mukhan biyad. It would be done immediately. V'kevon sha'asru ad she'im tim kutei she'asu, but once you don't gain anything from the non-Jew doing it for you, lo yomar alagoy la'asot lo. He's not going to ask the non-Jew, she'ra'enu mistaker klum. He's not going to gain anything, but ne'eshahu mit'akev la'er, because he has to wait anyway. Basically, the Rambam is saying, and others will spell this out much clearer, that there is a fear that Jews would ask non-Jews to do work for them on Shabbat, so therefore the rabbis made a law, you can't benefit till after Shabbat the amount of time it would have taken. But there's no such law when it comes to Jews, because the rabbis were never afraid that one Jew was going to ask another Jew to break Shabbat for him. Because if you care about Shabbat, you wouldn't do it, then why would you go and ask someone else to do it? That whole thing didn't compute for them, which means somebody who cared about Shabbat wouldn't ask another Jew to do it for them. So there was no legislation against a Jew doing work for another Jew on Shabbat, and therefore if a Jew did do work, you can use it immediately after Shabbat. In the case of a non-Jew, we have a law, Kadesh Shayaseh. So here we have a difference between the Rambam and Rashi regarding Kadesh Shayaseh. Okay. Shulchan Aruch rules like, should I tell you? You want me to read it and then you'll guess. Source 6. Hamavashel b'Shabbat, o sha'asar achad mishar melachot. You like what he did? Mm-hmm. Okay. B'mezid, on purpose, asur lo la'olam ul'ocheri mutar l'matzor Shabbat miyad. Whose opinion is that? Rabbi Yehuda. U'vishogeg, Asur bo bayom gam la'acherim, ula'erev mutu gam lo miyad. And the evening, it's allowed immediately for him as well. Who's that opinion? Also Rabbi Yehuda. So therefore, we see that we follow Rabbi Yehuda. That's the halacha, and if there are any Sfaradim in the room, the discussion just now ended. Yes.
I must have missed something. This one says that the Jew can benefit after Shabbat.
Right.
Immediately.
Right.
And what is it for the non-Jew? Who has to wait?
If only for non-Jew did he have to wait, and that's source number 7. That the Mogen Avram spells that out here, didafka ba'akum, specifically by a non-Jew, sha'asa bo'inon, we need, b'kdei she'ya'aseh, d'chayshinon, we're afraid, shem yomar lo, that he's going to ask him to do it, la'asot, avo yisro, lo yishmu lo, another Jew, he's not going to listen, which means there was never a legislation, there was never a fear that one Jew would break Shabbat for another Jew. Now, I want to just look at two specific sources over here to compare them for the moment. It will be number 8, which we're going to skip for the moment and come back, and source 11. Source 11 is the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef is of Yosef Karo. Do you remember we learned last week that we were not supposed to do what we just now did?
We
were supposed to read the Beit Yosef first. So first, before we read it, I'm going to help you a little bit. There were many, 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 many rabbis who lived before the Beit Yosef. How did he decide from all of those great rabbis who the law should be like? So what he decided is that halacha should be based upon the majority, but a limited majority. He only considered 3 sources. The 3 sources were the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. Now, just in case you don't appreciate this, the Rif lived in North Africa, the Rambam, bless you, lived in Egypt, and the Rush, who's our token Ashkenazi, do you remember he was the Ashkenazi who moved over to Spain? So over here, our 2 out of 3 that he needs in order to decide halacha, already you have what you call a stacked deck already in a Sephardic favor. And the Beit Yosef comes and says, listen, as far as I can tell, these were the greatest authorities in law who've lived in the last 500 years. And therefore, if you want to go through the whole Beit Yosef, he will always give you interesting background and tell you what all kinds of people say. But you want to know what his bottom line is? It's very simple to figure out his bottom line. It's 2 out of 3. If all 3 of them say it, then again, game over. That's the halacha. So the Beit Yosef is very predictable, very simple. Over here in source 11, and we're now going to read through the whole thing because you know the first part because you saw the Gemara already. First he quotes the Gemara. Next, where it's underlined, upasak harif k'Rabbi Yehuda, v'chein pasak harambam. By the way, do we have to go any further?
No,
the Beit Yosef, that's it, it's over. The Rambam and the Rif said something, that's all. And then he admits, where it's a little bit lower down, aval ha-tosfot katvu b'perek kama d'chulun mori lo k'Rabbi Meir. Tosfot said the laws like Rabbi Meir. Remember that was the Tosfot that we saw? Said, and why did Tosfot think the laws like Rabbi Meir? Because that's what the Gemara said, is that Rav said the law is like Rabbi Meir. And then he says, Mashma shekein halacha, v'chein dorash rabbi b'pirk, and he quotes the Gemara, Rabbi Meir, v'chein pasak asmag, v'sefer hatruma, and so on. What he just now did is quoted a bunch of Ashkenazi sources, which he'll reject all of them. Why reject all of them? Because he doesn't care. Why? Because he already has the Rambam and the Rif. Look at the second line from the bottom towards the end, Ula inyan halacha. You have that? 3 words before the end?
No.
The end of that paragraph. Ula inyan halacha, kevin shaharifa, rambam varrush, maskimim ladat echad. Being that the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam all agree, v'gam haga'onim v'ramban tzfurim kein, hachin aktin, and that's what we follow. Even though he'll admit there are lots and lots of Ashkenazim along the way that didn't. Now over here, the Rama didn't argue. The Rama basically said, yeah, that's a good point. The Vilna Gaon in source 8, that's the one that we skipped, he says, V'mashel b'shabbat b'shogeg, yochal b'mezid lo yochal, v'im kein alacha k'rav meir, d'shogeg yochal, v'gam b'drabanan lo kanis. And then at the very end he says, V'chein ikar l'halacha. What he does over here, and this should be fascinating to you, what the Vilna Gaon does in his analysis is he just goes back to the Gemara and says, what makes the most sense in the Gemara? I want you to appreciate something, because again, it's sophisticated and it's very important. There are layers and layers, and that was eight. There's layers and layers and layers of halakha. And every generation, there's more opinions and more opinions and more opinions and more opinions. And you can get lost when you live over here, peeling layer after layer after layer, trying to figure out. Now, if you live today, is your discussion trying to figure out what the Rambam said, what the Rif said, or is your approach trying to figure out what the Gemara said? The Vilna Gaon did not, I'm overstating it when I say doesn't care. I'd be correct if I say he wasn't swayed. If the Vilna Gaon was convinced that the Gemara said one thing and other people afterwards said something else, who's going to win? What's the Vilna Gaon going to say? With all due respect to the Rambam, I disagree with what you're saying here, because as far as I'm concerned, the Gemara is quite clear over here. While later people are going to have a hard time saying, well, look how many Rishonim said such a thing. By the way, you know who else viewed halacha in this way? Very often, Rav Moshe Feinstein. You read through some of his tshuvot, he does the same thing. He doesn't get involved in all the achronim, what everybody is saying. He goes straight back to what the Gemara says, has a question, goes back to the Gemara, what does the Gemara say? And just peels through all of the levels of the discussion. Rav Yosef Karo, you now realize, is very formulistic. What's he doing? He has a formula. What's his formula? Following two out of three. Rav Avadya Yosef follows the Beit Yosef. His way of paskening will be, he has his own set of people that he's impressed by, but most important person who he's impressed by is who? Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo. So therefore, if Rav Yosef Karo, the Beit Yosef, said something, for him, that's going to win out. Now, if there's a machloka, Beit Yosef and Ramah, he's not going to care it's the Ramah, the Beit Yosef wins out. But Rav Avadya Yosef, you read his tshuvot, he barely ever ignores all the other opinions and goes straight to the Gemara. So if you would look at the same question dealt by Rav Avadya Yosef and Rav Moshe Feinstein, you'd be shocked, because they're talking different languages and they're talking, that it's such a different approach. It's the difference of approach between somebody dealing with all the secondary literature versus somebody going and only dealing with the primary literature. Okay, now that may very well be a difference in Ashkenazim or Sephardim, even though there's many Ashkenazim poskim and many Sephardic poskim, but what I just now described to you is not a bad description of what took place. The Vilna Gaon is extreme, because the Vilna Gaon is able to say, he's not, okay, the Rif said this, the Rambam said this, it's not the issue. What's the issue for him? What did the Gemara say? So now, I want to move towards the bottom line today. The Vilna Gaon says the law is like Rabbi Meir. Why is the law like Rabbi Meir? Because that's what the Gemara said. So why are we getting so complicated? If we then look at the Mishnah Brura, source number 10, Mishnah Brura Zion over here. Here it said, the halakha said, the Shulchan Aruch said, that if it was b'shogeg, you can't use it on Shabbat, and neither can anyone else. Source 10, gam la'acherim, hinei b'gemara, the Mishnah Berurah. Now, Mishnah Berurah was written by who? Sorry, it was written by who? By the Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim died in 1933. We're not dealing with antiquity. You can go look back, you can find in the archives of the New York Times, you can find his obituary. He made the front page of the New York Times. Gam la'acherim, hinei b'gemara, in the Gemara itself, pligi b'inyan shogeg gemezid, Rav Meir v'Yehuda. By the way, it's interesting. He dropped off of Yochanan HaSandler. In the Gemara, there's an argument between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, because all the Rishonim you're going to look at, you're not going to find Yochanan HaSandler's opinion taken. That's basically rejected, which means as far as we're concerned, the law that you can't benefit from food cooked on Shabbat is a Torah law or rabbinic law? It's a rabbinic law. So he says, V'data Shulchan Aruch, who dat Rabbi Yehuda. And the Shulchan Aruch followed Rabbi Yehuda. You know this already. Shekein hi skimo harifa harambam v'hagaonim. Why? Because the Rif, the Rambam, you could throw in the Rush as well. They all agreed, so that's the halacha. And then the Mishnah Berurah writes, V'hagra hi skim b'biuro. And the Gra, in his explanation of the Shulchan Aruch, writes, he agrees with, L'shitat hatosfot, v'si atam. Notice, Tosfot and all the others who have the same opinion, which, by the way, again, I'm going to tell you, are many, many Ashkenazic opinions, depasku kerv meir, who agreed with meir, debemezit aser bein lo lebein lacherim, ad matzoi Shabbat, that if it's on purpose, then no one can use it till Shabbat is over, uveshogeg mutar gam lo miyad. But if you did it on Shabbat, beshogeg, you can use it immediately. And the Mishnah Berurah ends up, and for many people this is a bottom line of halacha, but I'll discuss that as well, uvemakom hatzorech, when necessary, yesh l'smochozeh bebishul beshogeg. That when necessary, you should rely on this when something is cooked by accident. So can I go back to the story in the beginning?
It's an emergency.
No, no, it doesn't say emergency. It didn't say emergency.
When necessary.
What?
The mom is doing it for
Shogeg. Good. So hold on 1 second, because to me this is just so black and white, there's nothing to discuss. He said when necessary. Did he say pikuach nefesh? What's pikuach nefesh? That someone's going to die. What happens when someone is going to die? What do? You break Shabbat, right? No discussion. Did he say over here, in a case of substantial financial loss? No, he didn't say that. What were the words he used here? When necessary. Now, how do you understand when necessary? Because believe it or not, on those two words, when necessary, I have all kinds of books that have discussions on this, and to my mind, it's a waste of time. I humbly or not humbly, disagree with these people that I have a discussion whether when necessary means chulant or not. I'm not kidding about this. If somebody did a mistake with the chulant, are you allowed to eat the chulant? So one guy says, absolutely, because chulant is necessary. And someone says, no, chulant really isn't necessary. So basically, if you like chulant, it's necessary. So I said, what are you, I'm telling you, I can bring this in. You'll make fun of rabbis if I bring this in to you. That they're having this whole discussion of what necessary is. You know what necessary is? That I have no problem saying. First of all, necessary would be if it's a main course, it's necessary. Why? Kavod Shabbat versus not having, or oneg Shabbat, if you want to call it. A main course is something you need. If it's vegetables, then forget it. But okay, I'm kidding. If it's you get my point. When necessary, how do I understand when
necessary?
Right. When necessary, how do you define that? When?
When it's necessary.
This should not be a complicated point. So what's the Mishnah Berurah saying? That when you need to, you rely on the Vilna Gaon. And by the way, is this some crazy, crazy heter of the Vilna Gaon? No. The Vilna Gaon is saying, this is what Rabbi Meir says, and this is what Rav said is the halacha, but publicly, we don't like to tell people this for whatever considerations we have, but that's the halacha. So I went back to this Rosh Yeshiva when he finished his class, and I said, I didn't follow one thing that you said. And he said, what? I said, the point about saying that you can't use the food, I missed that. And he goes, why? It's cooked on Shabbos, you can't use it. I said, you're familiar with the Mishnah Berurah? He said, yeah. I said, the Mishnah Berurah says when necessary. I said, would you consider honoring your mother a necessity? Would you consider embarrassing? Forget about another you. Forget about your mother. Forget about your mother, a host, your host. Exactly. Would you imagine embarrassing your host as being something which would not be included in this? I mean, what are you talking about? Honoring your parents is a Torah law. On the other hand, the law is like Rav Meir, the Mishnah Berurah says, what are you teaching these people? He, by the way, he had no idea what to answer. But I'm telling you that his mindset was so much that it's so important for them to know what's right and what's proper and whatever to be able, you know, it's the letter of the law. But it's not even the letter of the law in this case. It's just plain, twisted thinking. And the bottom line is it's not healthy halacha thinking. Because healthy halacha thinking is not how can I come out of this with the most strict conclusion. It's what am I really supposed to do in this particular case? And I go back and I weigh the various considerations. I'm going to embarrass a host who may have done something wrong. So I'll be very specific now. Let's say there's somebody who doesn't know that much about Shabbat and they take soup, which is cooked.
Stir it on the platter.
They take the cover off. You're not supposed to take the cover off while it's on the platter. They take the cover off while it's on and they stir it on. You're not supposed to do that. So now you say, listen, I can't eat this right now. You broke Shabbat. And I can tell you right now that there'll be many, many yeshiva bachrim who, that's it. You saw what they did. I can't eat the food right now. And if they're really from, then they'll tell them, you idiot, you're not allowed to do that, right? And that's if they really serve God properly. But it's right. Now, what's shogeg include? If you look at the Mishnah Berurah and source right before that, a couple lines on top of that, Mishnah Berurah Vav, number 6, b'shogeg, shogag b'din. You made a mistake. What the halacha is, Oh, shochach. Well, you forgot that you're not allowed to do that. Kol zeh b'chlal shogegu. So what's shogeg? Anytime you didn't do it on purpose is b'shogeg. So what's on purpose? If a person gets up and says, I want hinini, mamuchan, mezumen, right? to break Shabbos. So that would be considered to be mazid. But if somebody forgot that you're not allowed to do this, somebody made a mistake about this, so what's that called? That's called shogeg. So I can assure you now that there are all kinds of people get invited to, you know, all over, and they won't eat something, or they'll embarrass somebody, and all of this, I can say right now, is lo l'ruach ha-Torah. It's not what Torah wants from us. What Torah wants from us, this is the halacha. You want to be machmir in your own house? You want to be machmir by yourself? That you did something b'shogeg, you don't want to use it to after Shabbat? You want to follow Rabbi Yehuda? Fine, follow Rabbi Yehuda. If you have nothing else to eat, and I'm going back to my case of the main course, you have nothing left, nothing else to eat, and you're eating cold, you're eating gil. That's just the most disgusting thing I can think of right now. Gil. Right, and you have to eat gil instead of eating your chicken or whatever else it is, because you want to follow Rabbi Yehuda, you ask me, you can be included another example of the Chassid Shota that we learned about last week as well. That again, that would be what I would consider to be a case as an essay. You know what, I'll go even further. Any time which is necessary in my mind, if Kavod Shabbat, Onig Shabbat, or somebody's feelings are being impinged by it, that's the Tzorach. Right? If it's none, if there's none of those considerations, as I said, if it's just the vegetables, I can't believe it, I ruined the broccoli. Okay, so you ruined the broccoli. We'll get over it, we'll survive. It's terrible. Yeah.
But all that is only by accident, not on purpose. So someone doesn't know the halacha.
It's up by accident.
And they're stirring the soup on the halacha because they think they can do that.
Yes, that's accident. Should we read? Right. Let's read Vav. One second. Let's read Vav again. Take it off. Let's read Vav again. I'll give cooking lessons also if you want. Let's look at Vav again. Shogag bedin. You made a mistake with the law. O shachach. Oh, you forgot. Kol zeh b'chlal shogeg. And by the way, before that he told us, if you did it because your rabbi told you. Let's say your rabbi is wrong. You did it because your rabbi told you. That's also shogeg. All kinds of cases. Means what's not shogeg? If you did it on purpose.
No, you're not allowed right. To
I don't care. I just wanted to do maybe one last. Everything we did here, it's superficial. There's a lot more levels to this, but I think the bottom line you really got. There's one great tshuva over here, number 13, source 13. This is Rav Menashe Klein. Rav Menashe Klein is yes. Yeah.
Does that fall under the same thing?
It's not exactly the same case. This is Shabbat, and that's the truth is, forget our proper shkacha right now. Somebody walks into a religious woman's home and she says the food is kosher. There's nothing more to discuss. Right? If a woman's not religious, so then you may want to look at other things. It's a religious person's home, then you trust their food. Okay? And there really shouldn't be that much more to talk about. By, I'm sorry, because then you can't look down on people, and it ruins our fun. So I'm sorry. If by Shemitah, for example, by Shemitah, both Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein both said they don't necessarily follow the Het Mechira, but if you're in somebody's home and they serve you from Het Mechira, you eat it and you say thank you very much. So you know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said this. He wrote this in a book 50 years ago. So they've reprinted the book and they cut out all the sections that he wrote this. So the book now is a third of the size of the original book, because in the original book he accepted the Het Mechira and he had all kinds of discussions about it. He himself wouldn't do it, but he said it's certainly a bona fide heter. By the way, Rav Cook, who made the Het Mechira, the latest version of it, because it was before him, he was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Masadr Kedushin. And he was also Rav Yashiv's Masadr Kedushin. So both of them had a little bit of sympathy towards what Rav Cook actually said, and they respected him a great deal. So I'm saying even the Het Mechira, somebody invites you over, then, by the way, I heard the same thing from Rav Scheinberg, that if somebody invites you over, you don't ask. If they're a religious person, they serve you food, you say thank you very much, and you don't start asking them where the meat came from, where the chicken came from, or something else came from. Excuse me?
What are you based religious on?
If they keep Shabbos.
That's religious.
Yeah. Okay. Source 13, we just want to end with this because I like this. This is written by Rav Menashe Klein. Rav Menashe Klein is a contemporary. He's a very old man. Not very old. He's elderly. I've met him. He lives in Borough Park, and part of the year he lives in Ramot. You know those funny buildings there in Ramot? So he is a place, Bate Ungarin. He himself went through Auschwitz. He's a childhood friend of Elie Wiesel, and from what I understand, they still learn together. And Elie Wiesel's, the money that he gets from the Holocaust books goes towards Menashe Klein's yeshivas. Okay? Menashe Klein is a huge Talmud Chacham. He was the one who allowed to put the Erev up in Brooklyn when Rav Moshe Feinstein said no. He said, what are you talking about? In Europe, we always had Erevs in places that were big, like Brooklyn. I don't know what you're, and a lot of people followed him. A lot of people attacked him for that. Yeah, Chassidish. He's old-time Hungarian, and you will find some of the most fascinating tshuvot. What?
They're Romanian, not Hungarian.
He's not?
They're Romanian.
Right, okay, depends where the... Okay. Right. He has a wonderful tshuva here, source 13. Lintsoa ba'otobus miyad b'matzoi Shabbat Kodesh. Can you get on a bus right after Shabbat? I'm not going to read to you the whole tshuva, but you can look at it later. But where it's underlined on the next page, he says, "Umiu b'dida nira od ta'amim laheter." He says, "I have another good reason to allow it." Chad derei kfi ma shekatuv. I'm not sure what that is.
Is he talking about in Borough Park, or is he talking about?
He's talking about in Israel. He's talking about in Israel. Here's his consideration. He says, "When is Shabbat over for us? We keep Shabbat significantly after when Shabbat's really over. On a Torah level, when is Shabbat over?" So he says, why would you look at this law in terms, would you look at it, Rabbeinu Tam, that's another, you know, would you, three stars, three mediums, says, no, Shabbat's really, we're all machmir till the time it says in the calendar. But he says, in reality, on a Torah level, Shabbat's over before that. Look, we start Shabbat a little bit earlier than it's supposed to be, we end it a little bit later. So he says that when it comes to this consideration of after Shabbat, he says, why don't you just plug into this thing as well when Shabbat is really over, and therefore he says that you can even use it immediately after Shabbat and don't worry about anything else in terms of taking buses. And that's even if you consider all kinds of things, because part of the discussion over here, which the Mishnah Berurah does not accept, there's a source called the Prima Gadim, and he was of the opinion that a non-religious Jew today should be in the status of a non-Jew in terms of waiting the amount of time afterwards. Why? Because he says there's lots of non-religious Jews today who would break Shabbat for you. So the whole difference between religious Jews and between non-Jews and religious Jews no longer exists. The Mishnah Berurah saw that opinion, and he did not include that opinion, which would seem to me that he rejected that opinion. Even though you'll find the people that really want to be strict on this law will go back to that point as well. So therefore, the case that I said before about watching television, and by the way, I'll be very serious right now. You want to watch the news after Shabbat. It's not such a simple thing. They'll have the reporter come in from Washington. It's still Shabbat for him right then, which means you're right now benefiting from watching somebody break Shabbat. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I'm saying personally, if the reporter comes on from there, I would turn a channel. I wouldn't want to, because you're benefiting right now from somebody breaking Shabbat in front of you.
How do you know if he's Jewish?
The Israeli reporter.
Okay, I'm talking CNN.
I'm just saying that sounds to, Wolf Blitzer is Jewish. If the person is breaking Shabbat right now, I think that most of us should find that distasteful to be gaining from somebody breaking Shabbat. If watching the news is distasteful, right? if on the other hand, something was recorded on Shabbat and Shabbat is over right now, you know, I'm sure all of you watch all the soccer game highlights. No, I don't either. But after Shabbat, if you wanted to see that, Shabbat is over right now, so. There are people who would say, hold it, you can't watch it after Shabbat because these people broke Shabbat. And these people are all Mechalel Shabbos and so on and so forth. They're like they're non-Jews and you can never watch it. I don't agree. And we saw the sources. This person broke Shabbat. It's debatable whether they even know that it's Shabbat, even know the law, and they really are informed about it. And even if they knew about it, what's the opinion of Rabbi Meir? That after Shabbat, it's allowed to be used. It doesn't really sound like it should be the problem. As I said, the only place that I would draw the line is if right now somebody was breaking Shabbat and you were benefiting from it, you know, and I think that is considered a direct benefit. Anyway, I think the lesson that we learned today was very clear. There were a number of points of methodology along the way that I hope that you appreciated. You saw some again, I hope some interesting things in terms of the approaches that people took. But the bottom line over here to me is so clear that it's a little bit painful that when people get up and they instruct students otherwise, especially students are going to go home, and now basically what they were told is go home and abuse your mothers, and that's just not sound like the proper conclusion. Tov, Shabbat Shalom.